Hallo und herzlich willkommen hier einmal wieder mehr bei dem Podcast, wo wir auf die feine Art sprechen, auf die ganz feine Art und über die feine Art. Und zwar haben wir heute auch wieder einen sehr besonderen Gast. Ich werde jetzt auch gleich ins Englische wechseln, denn unser heutiger Gast spricht leider nur Englisch. Und zwar ist es Richard Benefield. So, hi Richard.
Hello Marcus and thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Thank you for being here, Richard. Our today's topic is art and foundations. But first of all, of course, I would like to introduce you, Richard. I had the pleasure of meeting you and getting to know you through the George Ricci Foundation, because I also work with a pair of people who own their own sculpture park a little bit outside of Berlin in Brandenburg. And this beautiful sculpture park had a work by George Ricci since its opening in 2020. And now in this year, there is a huge and wonderful nature-based exhibition with works by George Ricci in Brandenburg, in Schwante, in this beautiful nature sculpture park. And this is how we met, basically. You've been in the fields of art for a long time now, and you started out at the David Winton Bell Gallery at the Brown University, and you later moved on to the Museum of Art at Rhode Island School of Design. You moved on to the Harvard Art Museum, where you worked together with the famous architect, Lorenzo Piano,
one of the most incredible architects in the history, in the known history. If someone wants to visit, I think about what could be the closest architecture. It's maybe the Foundation Bayerler in Basel, or next to Basel in Switzerland, which is just a typical Lorenzo Piano building with all the lighting, with all the reflections, and also all of this connection to the nature around it. From there, you worked for the David Hockney Foundation. But before you entered the David Hockney Foundation, you met David Hockney through your role at the museum and you did the exhibition together.
Yes, I really had the great privilege of organizing the exhibition David Hockney, A Bigger Exhibition. That was what David wanted to call it. It opened in October of 2013 in the De Young Museum. It took up two floors of the museum. It's still the largest exhibition that David Hockney has ever had. And I had the great privilege to work with his curator, Gregory Evans, who really curated the exhibition. I wrote and edited parts of the catalog, which is a great catalog. I have to say, I think it is one of the most beautiful David Hockney catalogs. It's right up there with the Pompidou's catalog for the retrospective that they did in 2017. But yeah, that's how I got to know David. And subsequently, I sat for him to paint my portrait at one point. And then a year or so later, when the 82 Portraits and One Still Life exhibition was opening at the Royal Academy in London. My portrait was in the exhibition, so I had to go to the opening. And that was when I met with his attorneys and accountants to discuss becoming director of the foundation.
Okay, and now we're talking. Now we jump into the topic of today. So this was this something you expected, or was this out of the blue that you've been asked to do this?
It was sort of out of the blue, but I had actually said to my husband at one point, well, after I get out of this museum business, I would really like to run a foundation one day. And so it was sort of like my dream come true. You know, you make a list of all the things that you want to make sure you do before you die, and that was one of them. And now I'm in my second foundation, and I'm also consulting and advising other artist foundations on their operations and their strategic planning process, because strategic planning has been something of a specialty for me ever since I was at the Rhode Island School of Design and consequently at Harvard. And it's something that I really enjoy doing, helping figure out how to actually make things run and work.
So, and now maybe some of our listeners are already asking themselves, what
does an art foundation do? So what is the mission of an art foundation?
That's a wonderful question. And I want to make a distinction between art foundation and artist foundation, because I think both exist. Most of my experience has been with artist foundations, and primarily, or the sole reason for our artist foundation to exist is to advance appreciation and understanding of the life and work of the artist. And this is done in a number of ways, depending on what sorts of resources the foundation is left with or is given by the artist. Because in one case, I worked for a living artist. Now, George Rickey died in 2002. I work for a foundation that was set up by the artist, but to sort of carry on his legacy. And those assets, we'll call them, could be financial, it could be money, it could be art, it could be buildings, it could be archives, or it could be all of the above, which was the case with the George Rickey Foundation initially. We no longer have any buildings, but we have art and we have some money, and we have all of the archives of George Rickey, including all of his business papers, all of the transaction papers for his sales of works of art, and all of the drawings for the works of art as well, for his kinetic sculpture. We should say, you know, it's George Rickey's work is wonderful in nature because it moves when the wind blows, and it glistens and reflects the light when there's sunshine. So it really is a part of nature, which is what George Rickey really intended, the way he loved to see his work displayed. So that's sort of how an artist foundation gets set up. You know, it's it could be either a tax initiative in the case of a living artist where certain assets are donated to the foundation. That could be money, or it could be works of art, or it could be buildings, like I said, or archives, and or it's inherited ultimately upon the death of the artist. In the case of the George Rickey Foundation, he actually set up the foundation in 1996 or 7. And he set up the foundation because he wanted to make sure that ultimately a catalog raisonné of his sculpture would be created. And catalog raisonné is everything, you know, all of the sculpture. And that's one of the next big projects that the George Rickey Foundation will embark upon. We've now had a number of really great exhibitions to raise awareness of the artist along Park Avenue in New York City, on the High Line in New York City, this wonderful house and garden museum in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, a large exhibition with 12 outdoor works, and now this great exhibition at Schloss Gutschwanta with 7 works from the foundation and 1 work from Gallery Thomas.
So carrying on the legacy, this sounds a little bit abstract, but you already made some very concrete examples on what's the daily business of the art of the artist foundation in this case. So you've talked about the archive, you talked about giving access to the public, giving access to the archive, for instance, doing a catalog or producing a catalog raisonné as the collection, the latest collection of all of the works, all of the processes. And also you talked about exhibitions that you did. So can you maybe dig more into like the daily business of an artist foundation in this case? What is your aim to do? What are you trying and how do you proceed?
Well, your listeners in Germany and in Europe are going to find this hard to believe probably, but George Rickey is not nearly as well known in the United States as he is in Europe, and in particular in Germany. Germany has the largest number of Ricky works in public collections of any country in Europe. He lived in Berlin for more than 20 years. He spent half of his year there every single year in a small apartment, which was also his studio where he was able to work. And he really circulated in this like amazing group of artists who were living there before and after the wall came down. He was voted into the Akademie der Kunst and was a member until his death. So part of the reason that I really wanted to see this exhibition happen in Berlin is because we're trying to raise more awareness globally about George Ricky. We are trying to increase the scholarly discourse around the artist, to have scholars, philosophers write more about George Ricky's work, and to really settle his position in the canon of art history. Since he's not always discussed in every discussion about kinetic sculpture, even. People tend to gravitate back to Calder and the biomorphic works of Calder and not so much to the works of George Ricky, all of which were kinetic. That wasn't so with Calder. I think we're making some headway, and we're working now to organize a symposium on George Ricky and his life and work, and hopefully that'll happen in New York City in 2024. And, you know, like I said, we're just starting the process of the catalog resume, which is going to take up a great deal of my time in the next few years as I raise money for creating the catalog resume and organize and supervise staff who will be working on the catalog resume to get it ready to be presented online. Because our hope is to have a living, breathing catalog resume that's always accessible online, that is always up to date with the latest information. I've always felt very strongly, since I worked in academia for so long at Brown, RISD, Harvard, that it's better to get the information out there and find out what you have that's wrong and fix it than it is to protect it because you're afraid it's not right. So I hope that once we have this up online, the whole community of George Ricky lovers and George Ricky collectors will take advantage of it and actually participate in supplying the correct information that may not be correct there. But like I said, we have very good records on the works. So I'm looking forward to that.
And how does one have to imagine this relationship that you have to certain institutions that you've already mentioned? So you've mentioned museums, of course, who are also a part of academia, but also of the exhibition practice. You've mentioned academia, so universities, research. How does one have to imagine that? Is it just you writing emails to certain people and saying, hey, by the way, do you maybe want to do more research on George Ricky, or what's the process here?
Well, when you remember that I was in academia for 20 years and in other museums for another 10, 12, 13 years, I created quite a network for myself. There are a lot of curators and scholars who I actually know personally pretty much around the world. And in some of the most important institutions. So it's, you know, maintaining those contacts when it's time to do something, say, okay, what can you do? Who do you know? Who can you suggest that might want to deliver a paper or write an article? I don't hesitate to do that.
And what's your feeling about, how do you call it, predecessors, I think, or people, new students who enter university and they try to develop certain tastes or a certain interest. What's your feeling? Is there a raising interest, for instance, in the case of George Ricci? Is there new students who want to do research on these artists, on these historical positions? Or how is it passed on, the interest?
I hope there is. Part of when I start to talk to people at different institutions, whether it's Harvard or the Institute of Fine Arts in New York or institutions in Berlin, because I've been in touch with some people in Berlin, it's usually, you know, just trying to nudge those professors and those advisors to encourage their students or encourage other scholars who might not have thought to include George Ricci in their own work, to get them interested in it. And you know, this includes finding new ways to think about and to talk about George Ricci's work, and how do you position him in the context of other artists.
And going on to the other institutions, or going further to the other institutions, what does your relationship to museums and galleries look like? Of course, this is two different things. Maybe we start with the museums first. How is your approach to bring attention to George Ricci, for instance, again, with museums?
Well, everyone in Berlin will recall that while the Neue Nationale Gallery was closed for the wonderful renovation, the George Ricci sculpture was removed from the plaza, and I began conversations with the curator and the then director there at the time to make sure that the sculpture was going to return to its rightful position, and it did, you know. So this is one way. Also, when we had the Park Avenue exhibition in New York, I reached out to all the major museums in New York to encourage them to exhibit their George Ricci works during at the same time. Sometimes you don't have as much success as you do at other times. And museums are difficult to work with in the fact that they plan everything so far in advance, you know, that an 18-month warning is not as good as a 3 to 5 year warning for when you want them to participate in something or to get your artist's work out.
And now with the galleries, I mean, it seems like you're doing a great job, because parallelly to the exhibition in Schwante, there's also an exhibition in Berlin right now at the gallery Haas that you've already mentioned. So how is the relationship with galleries going?
Yeah, well, we have works in our possession that we would like to sell, and the main reason we would like to sell the works is to fund the work of the foundation. That is the development of the catalog resume, encouraging scholars. You know, if there were a really worthwhile project that would come to us, we would consider funding it. I don't want all your readers to start writing to me for money, but if they've got a good George Ricci idea, I hope they will. And but so we entered into an agreement with Kasman Gallery in New York. It had been called Paul Kasman Gallery until his untimely death. But Kasman Gallery in New York represents the George Ricci Foundation and sells the work that's in the collection of the George Ricci Foundation, as they do the works that are in the estate of George Ricci. And this reminds me we should talk about the difference in the estate and the foundation. But we made a conscious decision together, the estate and the foundation, to enter into this relationship with Kasman, because we felt that there would be greater likelihood of prices to rise if all of George Ricci's work was represented by one gallery. That's not to say that there aren't other galleries that have George Ricci works, because there are. And then working with the gallery, with, that is, Tasman Gallery, we developed a relationship with Gallery Michael Haas, and they currently have an exhibition up of George Rickey and Louise Nevelson works, which look wonderful together. Several of the works in the exhibition are from the collection of the foundation. Some of the works are from the collection of the estate, and some of the works are from the inventory of Gallery Michael Haas, because they do have their own inventory of Rickey works that they've acquired from the secondary market through the years.
You've just touched it a little bit. What is the difference between an estate and the foundation?
This is a really important distinction, and it may be slightly different in Europe. It is slightly different in the UK now. In the US, in general, the estate is the residual effects of when a person dies. It goes into the estate, and then something has to be done with it. Sometimes it's left to the family members. Sometimes it's liquidated, and it goes to various museums, or it goes to a foundation. In the case of George Rickey, the estate, because it also runs the George Rickey Workshop, which is a group of people who are experts, many of whom worked with George Rickey, they're able to do conservation, make adjustments to the sculpture, install the work, like Susanna Paul, who came to Svante to work with me on the installation. She was really the lead installer on the George Rickey sculptures. That is a for-profit operation. In other words, it's set up so that the owner of the estate can actually make some money from it. And the estate also owns sculpture, which they are willing to exhibit, but they also are very interested in selling them because, after all, the estate is a for-profit entity. The foundation is a non-profit entity, and it gives us a greater leeway, I think, than the estate, because we can talk to a larger range of people about George Rickey and his work. We don't exist solely to sell the work or to repair the work. We're really there to advance his legacy and to advance appreciation and understanding of his work and his life. So this is why we continue to maintain the archives, because the foundation owns all of the archives of George Rickey's workshop and his personal correspondence. And so those are the two primary ways. I mean, obviously, if you're for profit, you get taxed differently than if you're a nonprofit. We still get taxed, but at a very low rate of taxation whenever we sell a work. And that's federal tax. It's not, there isn't any other tax that we have to pay.
So we've established now that with the foundation and also in combination with the estate, you sustain a relationship with galleries, with museums, with academia. What would you say, how do foundations influence the rewriting or the writing and the reinterpretation of art history?
Well, that's a really great question, because that's what I'm really trying to do the most right now, is to try to make George Rickey more well-known, in particularly in the U.S., but really more well-known around the world, and to have more people be able to enjoy, appreciate his work, his beautiful moving sculptures. And, you know, that includes what we were talking about with regard to academia, curators in museums, etc.
Okay. So, also going back to your personal experience, what was the difference, or Yeah, what was the difference, or what is the difference between managing the artist foundation of a living artist and the artist foundation of an artist who died in 2002?
Well, that's a tough question. It's actually not that difficult. A dead artist can't talk back to you. And as the executive director, I sort of set the vision for the George Rickey Foundation. When the artist is still alive, the artist wants to be very much involved in the direction that the foundation is going, what kind of work the foundation is going to do. And David Hockney is a very hands-on. He really wants to be involved in every project that's about his work, which is great because, you know, I got to work with him on the great Hockney Van Gogh exhibition in Amsterdam.
Wow.
And, you know, it's not every day everyone who can say that they were able to work on a project like that with the artist, you know. So it's... You learn so much from the actual artist. And there are days when I wish I could say, George, what was this all about? Especially yeah. when I'm reading a letter that he wrote or looking at something in the archives. And fortunately, his archives are so complete that you can sort of always figure it out. But, you know, there's nothing quite like being able to talk to the artist.
Absolutely. Is this something that you like realize yourself, or this is something that has an impact on you, that you yourself are part of art history being written?
Well, I don't know if I would say that, but I guess I have been, since I actually organized one really big David Hockney exhibition, and my portrait is now in the David Hockney canon. But, you know, I will say this. If I hadn't had all the experience that I had dealing in museums, because in my very first job, I had to do everything. I was hanging the works in the gallery. I was doing the bookkeeping. I was creating the labels. I was communicating with the artists or with the galleries that we were borrowing from. And, you know, gradually as I went to the next position, oh, then I had people who were doing those things for me. But I understood what was involved in it. You know, I learned lots and lots at RISD and at the Harvard Art Museums from all of the conservators on the staff there, working with them daily, you know, of being elbow to elbow with curators and art historians, you know, some of the most famous art historians in the world at Harvard. So I had this, like, wealth of information that when I went to the David Hockney Foundation, and ultimately, really, I think a foundation of an artist who's no longer alive is a better example, because the body of work that you are given there, whether it's the archives or the sculpture or the drawings or the paintings that he did early in his life, you have to treat them like they're museum pieces. You know, they have to be cared for properly in climate controlled conditions. Well, the works on paper and the paintings do. And you have to know how to have a conversation with a conservator if there's a problem with the work. You have to know how to make a pitch to a curator or the director of a museum or the director of a gallery about why your point of view about something is the one that you really feel that they should take and run with it. So I couldn't have done this job if I hadn't had the depth of experience that I had in dealing with museums. Also, I had to deal with donors to the museums and all the issues that go with that. Sometimes they were outright gifts. Sometimes they were partial gift and a partial sale. Mm-hmm. So the museum was buying it, but at a greatly discounted rate. Just all of those sorts of things, you know, even understanding the correct museum procedure for creating a label for a piece of artwork. You know, it's just not something you get from running a bank.
Can you maybe pin it down to one event or maybe one specific process that had the most influence on you and how you perform your work today?
Well, I think that taking museums, particularly the Harvard University Art Museums, through the process of determining a new collection information management system mm-hmm. for the vast collections there. There are over 250,000 works of art in the Harvard collections. And we were living with a very antiquated, at that point, because we all remember how fast in the early part of the century technology was changing. And we realized that we had to make a change in the kind of database we were using in order to be able to make it the collections more accessible online. I think that's one thing, that and also working on websites, the whole just being really just absorbing everything that I could about the digital world, you know, being able to work with Google Glass while I was at the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco, or using GPS locating devices to guide people on a tour, you know, through the gallery. We experimented with all of that. And that was the great thing about being in San Francisco because we were in the middle of Silicon Valley.
Of course.
And of course, you know, after the pandemic, everyone was so used to using QR codes that I started insisting that there were always QR codes on labels of George Rickey's work so that it would take the person who scans it directly to the George Rickey website. So, you know, all of those digital experiences really contributed to what is the current George Rickey website, which I think everyone should look at, georgerickey.org. And we've tried to incorporate walking tours of the various exhibitions that we've had into that experience. And now, of course, you know, technology and great databases that are very powerful are going to play a large role in developing the George Rickey catalog resume. So I would say that really it's all of that digital experience when you add it all up, from going from museums that had it, but it wasn't quite up to speed, and then making the transition from that to something else and moving forward. That's really been a great boon to my ability to just say, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to create a new website. Let's get the designer, let's get the content manager, and let's go to it.
I want to stick to that. I want to stick to the digital era, to the 21st century, and how technology and technological innovations and technical equipment had an impact on how the work on an art foundation, on an artist foundation, has changed. So did you have like a feeling when this started? What was the time? Because you were involved, you've been involved already.
You know, it's actually kind of fascinating, you know, to be able to look at every one of those cards in the card catalog and then get all the information in. And it's just grown to where, you know, we're dealing with massive amounts of data that, you know, have to be migrated into new systems. And now one of the biggest thing that's happening with George Rickey's archives is we're trying to identify every piece of paper that might be necessary for creating the catalog resume, and we are scanning the piece of paper so that we actually have a photograph of it in the database, as well as, you know, typing in all the metadata to be able to find those pieces of paper and all the cross-referencing that's necessary. And it would be really great to have AI, which I'm sure it can do this, just be able to read those photographed documents. But this is really important because we've learned, and you know this, Marcus, because you work with my content manager who's in Los Angeles, Victoria Petway, She is the one that maintains our social media presence, and she maintains all of the content on the George Rickey website. It's really clear that to get this catalog resume completed, it's going to require people in all the corners of the world to be able to participate. And the only way we can really do that is through digital means. And we've all learned how to deal with Zoom meetings, and then everybody goes back and they do their work. And now we're trying to find ways that people in Germany can communicate with people in Los Angeles to collaborate on this George Rickey catalog resume. So, you know, I'm always open to ideas, as anyone will tell you, you know, and I don't have all the answers, but I'm willing to listen to lots of other answers and then sort of decide which one is the best one for us to follow. You know, I've had to make some decisions in the last year about things that we just were not going to do because it was going to take much too much time, cost much too much money, and for possibly very little results. So it's, you know, weighing all of these things, but it's clear that this creating a catalog resume, and I think this is true for all artists who are having catalog resumes created, it's really become a global exercise, you know, where there really are scholars, curators, gallery directors, you know, all over the world that can help contribute to the information that you want to collect into one place so that you have the most complete picture of the oeuvre of the particular artist.
Just a quick thought that came to my mind. Maybe that's also a difference between working with a living or working with an artist who already died, because you can always tell the living artist, stop painting. Please stop producing more work that we have to catalog.
I did get to say that to David Hockney once, because when we were doing David Hockney, A Bigger Picture, and it was the early it was like October the 7th or something, and the exhibition was scheduled to open on October 20th. I just said, that's the last painting you can add. You know, because he was still painting. I mean, some of those early portraits from 82 Portraits and One Still Life were painted in early October, and they were included in that exhibition, and then they ended up in the bigger portrait exhibition. So I actually did actually say that to David Hockney at one point.
I have a comparable experience with working with an artist, and we did an exhibition on Ukraine, on Ukrainian art, and we featured one of the artists who produced new works, new commissioned works for the exhibition. And when we arrived at his studio to pick up the works, and we brought a whole team, of course, of people to really do the package appropriately and to put everything into the transporter, and we arrived, and everything was standing there. It was not like in a foliage, or it was not secured in any way. And I said, okay, so Volo, how do you expect us to transport this now? And he says, yeah, we just have to carry it very carefully. And you have to like put your hands from the down part because the paint is still wet. I looked at him and was, what do you mean? The paint is still wet. Yeah, yeah, I've ended it. I finished it today in the morning because I had like a... quick idea how to finish it properly. Yeah, telling artists to stop painting. This is an amazing experience. So let's dig for the last part. Let's dig into the prospects of the future, because we've already talked about technology that exists. And of course, it's amazing that two people like us two, we have the opportunity to talk with 6 hours difference between us, and the internet connection is fluid and everything works well. But what is maybe like a technical, potential or a technical maybe innovation that is being discussed right now? You've mentioned AI, you've mentioned also like environment. What are you most intrigued about for the future in terms of technical opportunities in the context of Art Foundation, artist foundations, of course?
Well, I mean, just creating this sort of global community where other artists, art historians, professors, gallery directors, museum directors can actually contribute to the knowledge base of an of a particular artist. And in, you know, my case, it's George Rickey. I think that's pretty exciting, because it'll not only bring together more of the minds and voices of those people, but hopefully from that, a really new way of looking at something, a new way of thinking about a work of art, a new way of considering this artist might come to light, and we would be able to share that. Because, you know, the technology is the tool, and what I'm really trying to do is get the people thinking, because, you know, that's not something that you can leave up to AI to. I'm sure they could, AI could write a lovely essay about George Rickey if you ask it to, but it's just this whole thought process around the influences on George Rickey and the influence that George Rickey had on other artists, writers, philosophers, you know.
If there was like some sort of metaverse space or virtual habitat, and it would be able to display George Rickey works, would that be something that you would be into?
Yes, I would be.
Okay, because this is really, to close this topic up, this is something that I'm really very much looking forward in the current development of technical devices. And as we're moving forward with AI, of course, this is also an amazing technology. They have an AI which scans, I don't know, a whole collection of singular papers, and then it can tell you what's the content, how often was mentioned this and that, what's the material of the paper, from what year is it, and so on and so on. I think this is, of course, a huge improvement and a very nice tool to have. But I'm most curious about having really the experiential room, to have an experience, to have some sort of environment which you can enter, and then you have maybe something that is, of course, you will never exchange nature, you will never exchange this natural habitat that you have in Schwante, for instance, but to have some sort of simulation, some sort of environment that you can enter, to have at least, if you can't travel to Schwante, not anyone from New York has the opportunity, and you have the chance to really experience this in a digital environment, I'm really very much looking forward to that. We'll see what happens. Do you think this will happen soon? Do we have the experience soon?
Well, I don't know why it couldn't happen already, because, you know, we have these Van Gogh immersive exhibitions. I was in London not too many weeks ago to do the David Hockney immersive experience at the Lightroom, which was pretty remarkable, I have to say. It's not what you're talking about, though. I know, to be able to just transfer yourself into a wooded area with George Rickey sculptures blowing in the distance or around you, or, you know, with AI, the goggles on, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know about that. That's pretty interesting.
We will see. I hope we will soon have the opportunity to visit the, maybe even the archive or some sort of George Rickey exhibition in the metaverse. Richard, I'm happy. Do you want to add something?
No. Thank you for having me on. This has been a great conversation. You've made me think about things I didn't really know I was going to think about.
And also, of course, we had another little part of art history that we created with our discussion.
That's right.
Thank you very much, Richard, for being here, for taking the time to speak with me. And I'm really much looking forward to everything you do in the future and everything you have an impact on. And I think we will meet each other soon again.
Yes, we will.
Thank you very much, Richard.